to Psalm 33. This is where we'll begin our session this afternoon. This is a beautiful psalm that gives praise to God. Psalm 33, shout for joy in the Lord, O you righteous. Praise befits the upright. Give thanks to the Lord with the lyre. Make melody to him with the harp of 10 strings. Sing to him a new song. Play skillfully on the strings with loud shouts. For the word of the Lord is upright, and all his work is done in faithfulness. He loves righteousness and justice. The earth is full of the steadfast love of the Lord. By the word of the Lord the heavens were made, and by the breath of his mouth all their host. He gathers the waters of the sea as a heap. He puts the deeps in storehouses. Let all the earth fear the Lord. Let all the inhabitants of the world stand in awe of him. For he spoke, and it came to be. He commanded, and it stood firm. The Lord brings the counsel of the nations to nothing. He frustrates the plans of the peoples. The counsel of the Lord stands forever, the plans of his heart to all generations. Blessed is the nation whose God is the Lord, the people whom he has chosen as his heritage. The Lord looks down from heaven. He sees all the children of man. From where he sits enthroned, he looks out on all the inhabitants of the earth. He who fashions the hearts of them all and observes all their deeds. The king is not saved by his great army. A warrior is not delivered by his great strength. The war horse is a false hope for salvation, and by its great might it cannot rescue. Behold, the eye of the Lord is on those who fear him, on those who hope in his steadfast love, that he may deliver their soul from death and keep them alive in famine. Our soul waits for the Lord. He is our help and our shield. For our heart is glad in him because we trust in his holy name. Let your steadfast love, O Lord, be upon us, even as we hope in you. This is the reading of the word of God. And brother, please come and lecture to us.
When we studied paragraph one in the first two lessons, there were two words or two properties of the decree which we did not address, and I said we would look at them later. And we're going to look at them in this lesson because they go well with paragraph two of the confession. So what I want to do is talk about the liberty and certainty of the decree, and that's coming from chapter 3, paragraph 1, where it says that God hath decreed in himself from all eternity by the most wise and holy counsel of his own will, freely and unchangeably, all things whatsoever comes to pass. So there's your liberty and certainty, freely and unchangeably. And then paragraph 2 is related to this. Paragraph 2 says, although God knoweth whatsoever may or can come to pass upon all supposed conditions, yet hath he not decreed anything because he foresaw it as future or as that which would come to pass upon such conditions. So the liberty of God's decree, as well as the unchangeableness or the certainty of his decree, is reasserted from a different angle in paragraph 2 of the Confession of Faith. And rather unsurprisingly, the two main headings of this lecture follow the title, the liberty of the decree, and then the certainty of the decree. And you can see how the outlines are getting a bit simpler because it's a bit simpler now as we move forward from the initial first paragraph of the confession. So consider with me, if you will, in the first place, the liberty of God's decree, that God decreed all things in himself freely. God decreed all things freely. Again, this is asserted, but not really argued, at least in paragraph 1, whereas paragraph 2 does supply some of the arguments for why God's decree is free. So consider with me three things. Number one, we see here that the confession is in favor, it's pro, it argues, it asserts the knowledge, God's knowledge of simple intelligence. The confession affirms that because God knows himself By virtue of his knowledge of himself and his own essence, God knows all things possible. The confession says God knows whatsoever may or can come to pass upon all supposed conditions. God knows all possibles. So it's affirming God's knowledge of simple intelligence. And the verse that's cited in support of this is Acts chapter 15 and verse 18, where it says, "Known unto God are all his works from the beginning of the world." In other words, God knows all that he can do. God knows all his own works. He knows what he's going to do because he knows what he can do. He knows his own works. This is very important to reinforce that God's knowledge is a knowledge of himself. Why does God know all things? Well, because he decreed all things in himself. He knows all things possible in himself, and he therefore knows all that he will do. The confession asserts that God has a knowledge of all things possible, so it is pro-knowledge of simple intelligence. God knows whatsoever may or can come to pass. Which brings us to the second point. The confession denies it's against God willing in a way that is contingent on middle knowledge or conjectural knowledge. And we'll talk about conjectural knowledge in the next point. So the confession is saying that God did not decree based on a middle knowledge. Okay, well, what does that mean? Let's define this and look at it more closely. First, I want to review the scripture verses that are referenced in support of the liberty of his decree. His decree is not contingent. God's decree is not contingent on something outside of him. Let's look at the scripture verses. They're all in Romans 9. Romans 9, 11, 13, 16, and 18. In Romans chapter 9, verses 11, 13, 16, and 18, Paul says, "For the children being not yet born, neither having done any good or evil, that the purpose of God according to election might stand, not of works, but of him that calleth." So it's taking things a little bit out of context, not in the sense of misusing them, but it's very quickly or specifically appealing to certain things, where Paul says in verse 11 that God has a purpose which he is going to accomplish before these people have even exist, before they've done anything. God already has a purpose. So his purpose is not contingent on what someone will do. His purpose precedes that. Verse 13, "As it is written, Jacob have I loved, but Esau have I hated." Verse 16, "So then it is not of him that willeth, nor of him that runneth, but of God that showeth mercy." God will have mercy upon whom he will have mercy. Not waiting for someone to do something, not dependent or contingent upon someone else's actions. Verse 18, "Therefore hath he mercy on whom he will have mercy, and whom he will, he hardeneth," or he will withdraw from them. In these verses cited by the confession, there's an emphasis on the priority of God's will, that God's purpose of election and God's will to have mercy or to harden precede the existence of Jacob and Esau and any deeds that they might do or not do. It is not of him that willeth, but of God. So the confession is using these verses as evidence and support for the fact that God's decree is not contingent on creatures' supposed or future actions, but on God's sovereign purpose and will. God doesn't decree contingent on what someone may or may not do, but rather God decrees all things for his own purposes, independently or freely from the actions of man. So because God decrees all things freely, therefore he does not decree them contingently based on middle knowledge. Based on middle knowledge. But what is middle knowledge? Take a look with me briefly at the outline of the first lesson. The order of the first lesson, these 7 points, it's not just a convenient way of organizing the material for teaching. It's also very important for teaching the doctrine correctly. Because if you reorder some of these points, you end up in serious problems. And middle knowledge really comes from disordering these points. Middle knowledge is a hypothetical knowing prior to God's will. Let me see how it's in the... Yes, middle knowledge is a hypothetical knowing prior to God's will. So in the handout, notice how not God's knowledge of vision comes after God's will. God's knowledge of vision, God's foreknowledge of what will be, is what it is. His knowledge of vision is what it is because of what he has willed to do. His knowledge of vision comes after his will, after his wisdom has wisely selected what to decree among all things possible, and his will decrees it, or his decree is his will causing all things. His knowledge of vision follows from that. Because he has wisely willed all things, therefore he foreknows all things that he has willed to do. And so middle knowledge would take God's knowledge of vision and it would put it in front of God's will. Middle knowledge would take God's knowledge of vision and put it in front of God's will, where God knows future things which he has not yet willed. God sees what will be and then decrees it, basically. That's middle knowledge. God foresees what will be and then wills it to be. That would be middle knowledge. And this is inconsistent with God's aseity and his freedom. William Ames defined it in this way. This is in your handout. He said, "A middle knowledge by which God is imagined by some to have known before the decree of his will, by supposition, such events to come to pass, if such causes were put, seeing that it doth both determine events to come certainly to pass independently from God's will, and doth make some knowledge of God to depend chiefly on the object, I say such a knowledge cannot stand with the great perfection of God." Ames is saying, now God's knowledge depends on something outside of himself. Now his knowledge depends on an object which will be independent of him willing it to be. And that's impossible. Nothing can be apart from him willing it to be. So his knowledge of vision has to come after his will. But if he has a middle knowledge of some future independent of himself willing it, it destroys the whole system. It destroys and corrupts the doctrine of God. God's knowledge is now contingent, and his decree is therefore contingent. Ames utterly rejects it, as do all the Reformed. "I say such a knowledge cannot stand," he says, "with the great perfection of God." And this is what our confession is ruling out. Let's just take a look at the words again. "Although God knoweth whatsoever may or can come to pass upon all supposed conditions," yes, God has a knowledge of simple intelligence. He knows all possibles. "Yet hath he not decreed anything, because he foresaw it as future." Notice, the confession is supposing the possibility that God foresees as future and then decrees. It's considering the argument that the knowledge of vision, seeing the future, precedes God's will. And it's saying, no, that can't be. That is not why God decreed. Yes, God knows all things possible, but he's not decreed what he decreed because he foresaw something to be. That presupposes existence independent of God, and our confession rejects middle knowledge. The decree does not follow a knowledge of vision. God's knowledge of vision follows from his will and from the decree. This is not in your handout, but William Perkins said it this way. He said that God's foreknowledge of possibilities precedes the will of God. He knows all things that can be, and that precedes his will, yes, because it could be decreed. But God's foreknowledge of certainties follows the will of God because it is decreed. Let me read that again. God's foreknowledge of possibilities precedes the will of God because it could be decreed. But God's foreknowledge of certainties follows the will of God because it is decreed. It's just a different way of saying the knowledge of simple intelligence and the knowledge of vision, making that distinction. And of course, one of the things that this is accomplishing in the confession is a direct rejection of the teaching of Jacob Arminius, who embraced Molina's doctrine of middle knowledge as his argument for what we know as Arminianism. Now, I'm not going to get into that here because it's addressed more specifically in paragraph 5. Paragraph 2 rejects middle knowledge in general. Paragraph 5 rejects the use of middle knowledge as the ground for predestination unto salvation. The confession also deals not just with middle knowledge, but It deals with willing contingent on conjectural knowledge. So consider that with me, that the confession is contra, it's rejecting conjectural knowledge in God. God does not know what might be. God knows what may be, and God knows what will be. God does not know what might be. We affirm a knowledge of simple intelligence, all things possible, and we affirm a knowledge of vision. God knows all that will be because he has willed it. But to know what might be is rejected by the confession. God's knowledge is not conjectural or contingent, and so the decree is not based on conjectural knowledge or anything contingent. It is free. God decreed freely, not in any way contingent on anything. But you know, one of the beautiful things about the confession is how connected the chapters are to one another. Because what the confession affirms here about the freedom of God's decree, the liberty of his decree, has already been set up in chapter 2. Would you look with me, either in your hymnal or your phone or your confession, at chapter 2 of the confession and paragraph 2. I'm used to stepping away from our microphone at our church to take a drink, but the microphone goes with me here, so sorry about that. Step away from the pulpit when we sing. I can't get away from it here. I guess they can just turn me down back there. So in the confession in chapter 2, I want to narrow the focus down to where it says, partway down into the paragraph, it's talking about God's knowledge. It says that his knowledge, God's knowledge, is infinite, infallible, and independent upon the creature, so as nothing to him is contingent or uncertain. So in chapter 2, paragraph 2, the confession has already affirmed that God's knowledge is independent upon the creature. It does not depend upon the creature. And therefore, because God's knowledge does not depend on the creature, nothing is contingent or uncertain to him. Again, the actual most fundamental assertion is just God knows himself. God knows himself, and God knows all things possible, which he can decree and has decreed, so his knowledge doesn't depend on the creature outside of him, and is therefore not contingent on anything outside of him, and is therefore never uncertain, or his knowledge is infinite and infallible. So in asserting the independence of God's knowledge, or the non-contingency of God's knowledge, not only do we reject middle knowledge and conjectural knowledge, that's the negation. The affirmation is we affirm God's knowledge and decree to be free, utterly free. Why did God create what he created? There was nothing compelling him or causing him or moving him or forcing him or necessitating him. Pick as many words as you want. There was nothing that made his decree to be what it is other than his own wisdom. Freely. God decreed in himself freely and unchangeably all things. Again, this just reinforces the importance of that phrase, in himself. That God decreed in himself freely all things. If he decreed outside of himself, again, from some realm of forms or something, his knowledge would be contingent. His decree would be contingent. But no, God decreed in himself freely all things. Not based on middle knowledge, a hypothetical knowing of the future, or conjectural knowledge, a knowledge of what might be under some circumstance. No, God decreed what he decreed freely. That establishes the liberty of the decree. So we'll spend the rest of our time talking about the certainty of the decree. God decreed all things freely. It also says that God decreed all things unchangeably. What does it mean that God has decreed all things unchangeably? How does this relate to concurrence, which we described in the previous lesson? Wouldn't the certainty of the decree destroy the liberty of second causes? Wouldn't this make sin part of God's decree by necessity? A lot of questions actually still need to be answered. We need to reassert that there is a concurrence, a running together, between the liberty of the creature and the certainty of the decree. We make decisions and plans as second causes, and God's foreordained purpose comes to pass. Joseph's brothers did what they wanted to Joseph. The Jews did what they wanted to Jesus Christ. And yet the result was, as Peter said, what God had predestined to take place. Two things concurring. You chose to do these things. What God has predestined to take place has unfolded. So how do we understand the relation between liberty and certainty in the concurrence of the first and second causes? Well, we need to make further distinctions about different kinds of necessity. But consider four points with me as we develop this. In the first place, we need to look at an immutable, eternal cause. Why does the confession attribute unchangeableness to the decree? Well, it's the same as the heading or the title for the first session, the nature of God and the decree of God. The confession asserts that the decree is unchangeable because the one who decreed it is unchangeable. The decree is simply God willing what he wills to be. And God is eternal, without succession, and immutable, without mutation. So if a God without succession or mutation wills all things whatsoever come to pass, then the decree is an immutable and eternal cause. There's no succession in God. There's no process of deliberation or decision within which process a change might be inserted or imposed. Think about this. It's an eternal decree. We've already asserted that in the first lesson. It's an eternal cause. And it's an immutable God. So where are you going to insert the change? Where are you going to change his mind? How is that even possible? And could creatures, could time-bound creatures effect a change in the eternal cause of all things? Could the cause of all things be changed by the effect? No, God has decreed the end from the beginning, even the things not yet done, the scriptures say. So the decree is not only free, but also unchangeable, because God is free and eternal and unchangeable, and this makes the decree certain. Why is the decree certain? Because God is an immutable, eternal cause. This leads to more questions. If the certainty of the decree comes from an immutable eternal cause, which is God willing, God decreeing all things, doesn't this place an absolute necessity on all events such that the liberty of second causes is not real? If all things just play out according to the plan, is there actually liberty for the second causes? Well, we need to make further distinctions. In the second place, consider with me a necessity of infallibility. A necessity of infallibility. God's decree makes all events certain. They will certainly happen. They will take place necessarily. But the certainty or the necessity of these events is a specific kind of necessity or a specific kind of certainty, and it's a necessity of infallibility. It's the necessity of an infallible sequence. A necessity of infallibility means that there is an infallible sequence from an antecedent to a consequent. You're just saying words now. This isn't Jabberwocky. It's actually very important. So I have this, and this is also why I prepared these handouts to try and keep it all in mind at once. There is a necessity of infallibility means there is an infallible sequence. Think of a following, a chain from one thing to the next, from an antecedent, a thing that goes before, to a consequent, a thing that follows after. This consequent will follow this antecedent, or this antecedent will be followed by this consequence. We are saying that the decree makes all things certain in the sense of an infallible sequence. Things will follow things according to God's plan, according to God's decree. But here's the important further distinction. The chain, the links in the chain of this sequence, it's not that each link is causing the next thing, but that God has decreed that they will follow one another. It's not that each one is causing the next one, but rather that God has linked these things together to follow one another infallibly. So the events themselves that follow and proceed one after the other, They are hypothetical, and they're based on contingencies. But because God's will is immutable, events will follow events infallibly. So as things proceed, they could go a number of ways, but they will go the way that God has ordained them to go. I live in an asphalt jungle in La Mirada, California, at the border of Orange County and LA County. And everywhere all around me are streets and intersections forever and ever and ever. So when I take my son to school, there are a large number of possible routes for me to take, each of which will end up at school. At each stoplight, I make a decision to turn there or to wait and turn at another stoplight. I follow the course of the lights and the flow of traffic and all such things. But each stoplight presents me with a choice. And along the way, there's nothing about a particular intersection that forces me to turn at it. Each intersection presents me with the option, turn left, go straight, or turn right. And each choice may affect the next. There are contingencies, but being at a given intersection does not necessitate that I take one of those paths. In fact, I could drive away from the school if I wanted to. Now, the necessity of infallibility, which results from the certainty of God's decree, means the path that I freely choose to take was the path that God decreed I would freely choose. God's decree made the sequence a certainty or necessity, but the links in the chain, the steps in the sequence, were not necessitating the next links or the next steps. So among my possible routes, the one which I took indeed was according to God's decree. But it's not that each step was forcing the next step and I couldn't have done it otherwise. No, I could have chosen to go a different route to school. At every single choice, I could have made a different choice. So the sequence was decreed infallibly, but not as though each thing was forcing the next thing. So I have a true liberty, and there is a true infallibility of God's decree. God's decree makes all things certain by a necessity of infallibility. There is an infallible sequence where you have antecedents and consequence, but the antecedent is not causing the consequence. They just follow one another according to God's decree. We'll continue to talk about this and develop it further. It may become clearer by contrast. So consider with me in the third place, a necessity of compulsion. If you're doing reading in the 17th or 16th centuries, sometimes this is called a necessity of coaction. Same thing, different terms. A necessity of compulsion and a necessity of coaction. Same thing. A necessity of compulsion means that something happens as the direct effect of a direct cause. So if you push me, my fall will occur by a necessity of compulsion. You have compelled me. The effect, my fall, is the result of a direct cause. Why did I fall? It was necessary that I fall because you so caused it. You so pushed me. What we are saying is that God's decree does not, let's be clear about this, God's decree does not place a necessity of compulsion on free causes or on creatures. In other words, the first cause is not compelling the second causes to do what they do. It's not forcing the second causes to do what they do. In particular, God's decree does not compel the will of creatures. Our will remains free. And so by non-compulsion or non-compelling, what we mean is that God's decree sets all things in motion, yes, in an infallible sequence, but always in accordance with the nature of things. God's decree does not move creatures against their nature or against their will. That would be a necessity of compulsion, where God is forcing, and my actions are the direct effect of a direct cause. But my actions are not the effect of a direct cause of God pushing me. They're the effect of my own free choices, which are unfolding infallibly according to God's decree. So the infallibility or the certainty of the decree is an infallible sequence, not where each link in the chain forces the next one and compels the next one, but rather God has ordained that this will follow that and this will follow that, unfolding according to his wise plan. When we affirm a necessity of infallibility in the decree, and we deny a necessity of compulsion in the decree, then we see the true nature of the concurrence of the first cause and second causes, that God's decree is moving all things toward his decreed end, but in such a way that second causes act necessarily, freely, or contingently according to their nature. So as our confession says, God's decree establishes the agency of second causes. If God's decree made all things certain by a necessity of compulsion, then the decree would take away the agency of second causes. But because it makes all things certain only by a necessity of infallibility, it establishes the agency of second causes. This leads us to another question. There's always more questions. If the decree establishes a necessity of infallibility without a necessity of compulsion, are events avoidable? Are events avoidable? So let's talk about evitability and inevitability. We've said that events unfold according to God's decree infallibly, but not by a necessity inherent to the events themselves. Why did this happen? Because it had to happen. Because it had to happen. No, not like that. The events themselves depend on the actions of free agents and all kinds of contingencies, which are neither natural nor inherent, or their necessity is neither natural nor inherent. So, therefore, we can make an important distinction between an action considered in itself and the same action considered in relation to the decree. If we consider an action in itself, it is evitable. It is avoidable with respect to man's liberty. Man is free and able to do or not to do a thing. But if we consider the same action with respect to the decree, it is inevitable because God's decreed sequence will indeed play out. And this is what we already stated. At a given intersection, I choose which way I want to go. And I could choose otherwise. I can choose to stop talking. But what I choose freely concurs with God's eternal decree. There's a quotation here from Francis Turretin in the handout for you, as well as a few more quotations to help try to complete these thoughts. So to restate the assertion, an event considered in itself is evitable or avoidable from the perspective of the creature. We are able to do or not do things. But it's inevitable in the sense or with relation to God's decree, which makes all things certain, not by compulsion, but by infallibility. It says, all things are certainly predicted as future, so that the word of God cannot fail, nor can Scripture be broken. If God has said this will come to pass, it will come to pass certainly. Therefore, they, those things that are certainly predicted, must happen necessarily. If not as to the mode of production, which is often contingent, still as to the certainty of the event, which cannot be otherwise. So Turretin is saying that how is it that this certain event in the future will come about? He says it's not necessarily going to come about by a necessity of compulsion. It could come about by many contingencies, but it will come about. So without using the terms, he's making the distinction between a necessity of infallibility, not a necessity of compulsion. He's saying these things will certainly happen as to the event, which cannot be otherwise. But how it will come about depends. It's contingent on the mode of production. God can work it any number of possible ways, and we don't know exactly how it's going to arrive at that end, but we know it will arrive at that end. So all things are certain, but it's not certain to us how it will get there. And so you make choices, and things are avoidable from your perspective, and it unfolds according to God's foreordained purpose and decree. William Ames gives us a really interesting example. I like this one a lot. He says, the will of God does not infer a necessity upon all future things, but a certainty only as touching the event. So this is, again, making the distinction between a necessity of infallibility and a necessity of compulsion. The first thing he says is denying a necessity of compulsion. The will of God does not infer a necessity upon all future things. They're not compelled, but a certainty only as touching the event. They will take place. So it could not be as to the, there's a typo here, so it could not be as to the certainty of the event that the bones of Christ should be broken, because God would, he willed, that they should not be broken. So God has willed that Christ's bones should not be broken, so there is a certainty that Christ's bones will not be broken. Yet, there was no necessity imposed upon the soldiers' spears and other second causes which were present. He's saying if you tried to spear Christ's bones, there wouldn't be a force field that deflects you away from it. But God so ordained everything that the soldiers didn't break his bones. It's not that they couldn't do it. It's that they didn't do it. God's decree made it certain infallibly, but did not compel it by altering the nature of second causes. The soldiers were not forced not to break his bones. They chose not to break his bones freely, and their spears could have broken his bones, but they didn't. So therefore, it is true that the free but dependent agent can do or not do the same action. Yet the option that the agent chooses freely has been decreed infallibly beforehand. So this is why sometimes it's more helpful to talk about the certainty of the decree instead of the necessity of the decree, because there's different kinds of necessity. And if you say the decree makes all things necessary without distinguishing between infallibility and compulsion, people will rightly criticize and say, then there is no liberty in second causes. It's a farce. We're just simulations or something. So God's decree makes all things certain by a necessary sequence, but not by compulsion. And the usefulness of the doctrine of concurrence, that the first cause concurs with second causes, is that it preserves the liberty and agency of the Creator and the creature, each in measure with their being. In every action or event, man works according to his agency, and God according to his. Man wills all he can will, and God guides all things to their proper ends for his own purposes, resulting in his own glory. And this also preserves the responsibility and culpability of man. You will say to me then, why does he still find fault? For who can resist his will? But who are you, O man, to answer back to God? Paul says in Romans chapter 9, we have not done anything that we did not want to do. God does not compel the will of man. Our arms don't move unless we move them. Our legs do not walk unless we move them. The glutton does not cry out, help me, the food is forcing itself on me. The drunk does not say, help, the bottles are attacking me. We're responsible for our actions because our actions are evitable. They're avoidable. This relates to the decree in sin again. How can man's choice to sin be free if God's decree is infallible? Because God's decree does not make it infallible by compulsion, forcing the man to sin. God's decree makes it infallible through an infallible sequence. It makes it certain by an infallible sequence. Man will choose to sin. God has ordained to permit the man to sin. It will take place, but he has chosen to sin. John Norton says it well this way. It's in the handout for you. The decree, though it be the antecedent, that is, the foregoer of sin, the decree comes before sin, yet it is not the cause of sin. And sin, though it be the consequent, that is, something infallibly following upon the decree, yet it is not the effect thereof. What's he doing? He's making the distinction between a necessity of infallibility, antecedent consequent, and a necessity of compulsion or coaction, direct cause, direct effect. The decree does go before sin as an antecedent to a consequent, but not as a direct cause to a direct effect. He says, the day goes before the following night, and the night foregoes the following day. Yet night and day are far from being causes of one another. They're a necessary sequence, an infallible sequence. the diligent attending to the difference between an antecedent and a cause, and between a consequent and an effect, is of great use to untie many knots in this place. So the decree, yes, is an antecedent to all things, sin included. And all things are the consequent of the decree, which is antecedent, but not by cause and effect in terms of direct cause and direct effect, not by compulsion, but by infallibility. So again, we are not compelled to make the choices we choose, and yet we infallibly, freely choose what God has infallibly ordained to take place in an infallible sequence. Well, in sum, and in conclusion, the certainty of the decree is not at odds with the liberty of the creature. God has decreed all things so that they unfold infallibly, yet without compelling man's will, because God has decreed that certain events will take place through necessary causes, through free causes, and through contingent causes. And God allows or has ordained that necessary causes will work necessarily, and that free causes will work freely, and that contingent causes will work contingently, all of which work together to accomplish his will in an infallible sequence. Nehemiah Cox provides a helpful summary, and we'll conclude with this. Among things future, some are good, some are evil, namely morally, morally good, morally evil. Those that are good, God decreed to effect. Those that are evil, to permit or suffer to be done, knowing how and having purposed in himself to order them and overrule the doing of them for his own glory in the end. Again, some things we see are the effects of causes that work necessarily, necessitate consequentis, which means by a necessity of the consequent, that's a necessity of compulsion. Some things work necessarily. This causes that. Others are the effect of free agents, which are to us wholly contingent, yet do also necessarily come to pass, necessitate consequentiae, by a necessity of the consequences or a necessity of infallibility. And things are therefore thus effected in time, because God had decreed this order before time. Hence is the certainty of God's foreknowledge, which depends not on anything without or outside himself, and so a necessity as to the event, that whatsoever has been or shall be should so come to pass as it does. But this is a necessity of infallibility, not of coaction or compulsion, and does establish, not infringe, the liberty of free agents. So in conclusion, God has decreed all things in himself freely and unchangeably, whatsoever comes to pass. And God's decree is free because his knowledge is not contingent or dependent on anything. It is independent upon the creature, as chapter 2 said. God has decreed in himself. He did not decree something from middle knowledge which precedes his will. God's decree is free. God's decree is also certain. It's unchangeable. This certainty causes an infallible sequence, but without compelling the will of creatures in any way contrary to their nature. The first cause establishes the agency of second causes and concurs with them. God created a world of true free agents, and he works out his purposes and accomplishes his sovereign and unchangeable decree through their good and bad free actions. Now, I want to ask you to bear with me, or I guess not, you've already done this. I want to thank you for bearing with me in these first three lessons, because it is not ordinarily my custom to read my manuscript so closely. But in these things, I feel a necessity. I feel compelled to do so because the distinctions are so fine and so specific that I want to guard my words as carefully as possible. So I hope that as I've been reading my manuscript a bit more closely, you having the outline to follow me has helped us work through this together. But I want you to understand that ordinarily I would try to be a little bit more engaging with an audience, and it's been my own weakness that has forced me to act in this way. Now, if you want to eat dinner, go eat dinner. And if you don't want to, don't, because you can do what you want to do insofar as you can know it and will it. Thank you for your attention.